Hello, bonjour, and welcome to the Great Fright North, a twice-monthly podcast, shooting and passing opinion, trivia, reviews, and more on horror and sci-fi movies, books, and games, while making sure to spotlight Canadian film, actors, and directors as often as possible. We'll, of course, be exploring cinema from around the world and all eras, because I love it all. Now come help us celebrate over 100 years of cinema thrills, you hoser. Hello, it's Dave again, and thanks for joining me up here in the Great Fright North. It's an appropriately chilly day up here in early December. We just got some snow. I'm super excited. I love this weather. I've just put the snowblower away, though, and I'm ready to flap my gums about some movies. I hope you are, too. And before we get into the brain tonight, I just wanted to talk a bit about the drive-in in 2020, particularly up here, since we do have one that I go to with my wife quite often. So we're coming to the end of 2020 here, which for everybody has been the year of COVID. And almost everywhere around the world, theaters were shut down. There was very little to do for a long time. And the drive-in really came roaring back. If you were going to, you know, talk about it in wrestle speak, in 2020, the drive-in really got its push and it got over big time. So right now the drive-in's got a lot of heat. Oh my God! The drive-in put the Hurricane Rana onto the theater. He's got him in the center ring with the figure four leg lock. The theater can't reach the ropes. Will he tap out? Well, like most great baby faces, I doubt that. I predict that the theater will rise again. But for right now, the drive-in is hot, man. And we're lucky enough in my community to actually have one. I know that's not the case everywhere. Over the last 20 years, a lot of them have closed. You know, it wasn't really that cool to do anymore. But around here, we actually, interestingly, have two of them now. Just down the road in Woodstock, there was, I think it was called the Starlight Drive-In. It closed maybe over a decade ago. But there's a family there that actually reopened it with the push that the drive-in got this summer. The owners and their family, it had been their dream to open this drive-in forever, but they figured it would never happen because of just the way, you know, people just weren't going to the drive-in anymore. Sort of like camping, it was a dying thing. But they did get to open it. They spent some money, took a risk, and they made a really good show of it this summer. It's pretty cool. So technically in my area there are two, but Woodstock's not exactly that close. I go to the Mustang drive-in a lot, and they just killed it this year. If you do have a drive-in in your area, if they're open, you know, if you live in a warm area where they're going to stay open all winter, check them out, support them. If you don't, next summer, try to make a point of going. Because nothing came out this year, they had a really interesting time of it this summer. They played mostly, you know, what you would call second-run movies. But for us, particularly here in London, man, it was an awesome summer for horror movies. The company Grindhouse Releasing, they toured their remaster of Evil Dead. So we were lucky enough to go see a double feature of the original Evil Dead and Pieces, which is also another great Grindhouse classic. We were also lucky enough to see the Rocky Horror Picture Show at the drive-in this summer. It was an interesting experience. I've seen it, almost every way now. I've seen it live on stage, the Rocky Horror Show. I've seen it in the theater and now in the drive-in. And at home too, right? I own the Blu-ray. The theater is still the best, but the drive-in was kind of fun. You could tell everybody knew the words to the Time Warp, but if you listen to what was going on during the rest of the movie, people were trying to do the play-along thing, but it's harder, especially because of COVID. They really wanted you to stay in your car, so getting out and dancing and stuff like that was a little harder. But you could hear a lot of flubbed lines in some of the other songs, so the Time Warp is obviously the big hit from that movie, which is, expected. Also, the guys who run Shockstock, since they couldn't run their convention, they had a little horror fest when things loosened up a bit. So there was about 6 or 8 vendors allowed to set up tables in the drive-in, socially distanced, of course. And they played Lucio Fulci's Zombie and Spookies, which was a great night. The Mustang actually opened their season with an awesome double feature. It was Jurassic Park and Jaws. And Jaws went over like gangbusters, man. People loved it. It was getting gasps and screams, so it was such a good night there. They played stuff like Halloween and Nightmare on Elm Street, Empire Strikes Back. My wife and I went to another Steven Spielberg double feature. It was Goonies and Gremlins. I know he didn't direct Gremlins, but he's involved in both of them. So yeah, particularly around here, the Mustang Drive-In, I just want to give them a shout-out. They killed it this year. We go often, as I said, because you can bring the dog and usually sit outside. Hopefully it'll get back to that again next summer. But I hope they also keep their momentum rolling and are able to, you know, sustain this business for a long time. The unfortunate thing is, it's not unfortunate, the thing for the drive-in is communities grow, so they've been pushed out. Luckily, like I said, here in London, they're still pretty far out of town. I mean, 5 minutes out of town, but the city's not growing in that direction right now. So the Mustang should be around for a long time. And the Oxford drive-in that I had mentioned earlier, they're kind of interesting too, because they're on Old Highway Number 2, and they're right between the Woodstock Flying Club and the Oxford Park Memorial Cemetery. So, you know, they're in a nice, creepy little interesting nook there on the highway. And I don't think Woodstock's going to grow out that way. So if they can keep making money, they'll be around for a while as well. The drive-in, the topic of the drive-in, I don't know if I can stretch this into a whole episode. So since around here, obviously weather dependent, the snow is here. So what I mean to say is the drive-in's closing. I just wanted to mention them and I figured we'll just put it at the beginning of this episode. If anybody has a suggestion of how talking about the drive-in could be stretched into a whole episode, please let me know. I don't know if my love for it really comes out in this little segment here, but I've been going to the drive-in my whole life. I think it's an amazing way to see a movie in the summer under the stars, and it's not everywhere anymore, so I don't know. I just want to just spread that love out. I'm done with that now. All right, we'll get into the movie I wanted to talk about today. That's 1988's The Brain.
I think it's hungry.
Don't tease it.
That thing is trying to control us. I can feel it.
That is your imagination.
There's been 8 deaths since you began TV transmissions of the brain's hypnotic wave. Is that my imagination, too?
There's no connection that can be proven scientifically.
Resistance to the brain's hypnotic wave causes hallucinations, and you know it!
Your mediocre mind cannot begin to comprehend the importance of my work. I suggest you look into your own neurotic behavior, then perhaps you will understand your continuing negativity.
You have to stop this insane research. That thing isn't satisfied just controlling the minds of the people who watch your TV show.
It's apparent you and I will no longer be able to work together.
Fine with me, but wait till I tell people what's really going on around here. Now take that thing and bury it where it belongs!
So The Brain, from 1988, directed by Ed Hunt. This is a fun little movie, and it's got a lot of nostalgia value for me. I don't love that expression. I'll think of something else for episodes to come, but just because you have what someone calls a nostalgic feeling towards a movie doesn't mean you didn't love it and don't still love it. It really shouldn't have much to do with it. Anyways, that's another topic for another day. This was a video staple back in the 80s and had a great cover, a great poster, and it was everywhere. Up here, at least, anyways. Ed Hunt, the director, he's not a Canadian, he's from L.A., but it looks like, from his IMDb, he made a couple of movies up here in Canada. Let me go through some of these pretty interesting ones with you. The descriptions on IMDb are pretty funny. He doesn't have the longest, well, he's directed more movies than I have, but he's got 13 director credits. They start in 69, and pretty much end here in 88 with The Brain. He's got one more in 95, The Jungle Book, The New Adventures of Mowgli, which looks like that's a video game, and then in 2014, Halloween Hell. But if you go back to, so his first one in 1969, A Freudian Thing, this sounds like maybe some softcore or a blue movie. not quite hardcore. And then something in 73 called Corrupted, which it could be softcore, but it also could be a thriller. It's hard to tell from the description. And then Diary of a Sinner in 1974. And this is the one that sounded really interesting. Let me read you the description of this. Oh, I got all mixed up there. Sorry. It was Diary of a Sinner from 1974. You gotta hear this description. I gotta look for this movie. Dave, great name, a broke, out-of-work actor, moonlights as a pimp. After breaking up with his girlfriend, Dave befriends loner Tom and proposes a suicide pact. In 1 week, they will flip a coin and the winner will kill himself. That sounds pretty interesting. Anyways, after that, the last one I mentioned, 76, was Point of No Return. In the late 70s, it looks like he starts making some movies here in Canada. Starship Invasions, Plague, a TV movie, a documentary. And he did the 1981 Bloody Birthday, which is, if memory serves, it's an interesting one. It's not as great as Happy Birthday to Me, but it's a good one too. I don't know if we'll get to it on the show. And one more before The Brain, in 1985, Alien Warrior. If we go into the cast, there's lots of great Canadiana down here. We're in the 80s, so there's people that will come up many, many times. The lead is Tom Bresnahan. He's an American. He was working up here. He was also in Ski School, which was kind of a sex comedy that made a bit of money on video back then. And Cynthia Preston, she's in a ton of stuff. She's still working today. She's a big-time Canadian actress. I mean, not the most famous, but when you work this long and this hard, I call you big-time. She's been working since way back in, well, it was right before this movie, but way back in 88, or 86, sorry. She was in a couple of TV series, Miles to Go and Hanging In. She, unfortunately, was never on any episodes of The Littlest Hobo, but she was in this is a Canadian staple on television, was Night Heat, I've mentioned it before, it was the cop drama. She's also in an episode of TNT, T&T, which was Mr. T's television show. It filmed up here in Toronto. He was an ex-con who now worked for a lawyer. I loved the heck out of that show. Man, I didn't even remember that existed till just now. And she's also the sister in a great movie called Pin. It's an underrated Canadian classic. It's an underrated horror classic, let alone being Canadian. But we'll definitely get to that one on the show. Then in The Brain. And she was actually the voice of Princess Zelda in the Super Mario Brothers TV show, The Legend of Zelda TV series. And she did a couple of the video game voices. She's in a couple of episodes of Friday the 13th, the series. And Prom Night 3, The Last Kiss. And a couple of episodes of My Secret Identity. Oh, wow, that's another great Canadian TV show. And that had here's the power of editing, because I can't remember. Oh, young Jerry O'Connell as a kid who gets some superpowers from his neighbor, the scientist, experiment gone wrong. Anyway, she also was on Street Legal, another Canadian staple on television. She was in the movie If Looks Could Kill. And then tons of television, Neon Rider, Whale Music, it goes on and on through the 90s, into the 2000s, some General Hospital. Looks like she was on an episode of Hannibal, which filmed in Toronto, so yeah, a lot of Canadian talent on Hannibal. Even in American Gods up here in 2020, wow, that's great, good for her, still working. And the main villain, everybody, well, all horror fans will know him. David Gale, great name. He was in Reanimator and Bride of Reanimator, The Guyver. He's in L.A. Law. I guess he was in an episode of The Naked Gun right before, or right after The Brain. I thought he would have had a much longer IMDb, but he did die pretty early. Unfortunately, I believe in 1992, he passed away quite early. He's only 54. Yeah, that's too bad. But he's super hilarious in Reanimator. If you haven't seen it, I'm not going to spoil it. But he's got some scenes with Barbara Crampton that will blow your mind. Bride of Reanimator, he doesn't get as much to do in that one. The Guyver, I remember seeing that. That's based on a Japanese manga, but I don't remember him in it. And here in The Brain, he plays a character similar to what he did in Reanimator. He doesn't have as much scenery to chew, but he's still a lot of fun in this. And he's always very intimidating. He's got that great look and voice, you know. And his number two, his enforcer or hitman or whatever, is George Buza. I love George Buza. He's another Canadian staple. He's actually immigrated from the States. He was born in the States, but he's lived here since the 80s. I believe he's got his Canadian citizenship now. He's in so much stuff. He was the voice of Beast and Cyclops on the old X-Men, the 90s TV show, which was made up here in Canada. I bet a lot of you didn't know that. His IMDb is huge as well. We'll go way back. One of his first IMDb credits is, a great year, 1975. That's when I came into town. He was on Kung Fu. And, I mean, almost from way back then, he's working in Canadian stuff. Although in 1981, he was in Quest for Fire as one of the Chasm tribe, but he was in guesting on a television show called Bizarre, which was a cool comedy variety show. He was on an episode of SCTV, Today's Special, which was a morning kids show. Hey Man, he did Three Littlest Hobos. Oh, a two-parter, The Three Monkeys of Ba Roger, Part 1 and 2, and then Diamonds Are a Dog's Best Friend. He was on The Edison Twins, which was another, if you're, your late 30s, early 40s here in Canada, you remember The Edison Twins. It was kind of a semi-educational mystery show. And then tons of, oh my god, look at all this voice work he does in animation. Lots of work on Star Wars Droids, and then the Ewoks animated show. And then back into movies and television. He's on Night Heat, and Meatballs 3, Magical World of Disney, Alfred Hitchcock Presents. Oh my, we're still in the 80s here. Voices on the television show Babar, if anybody remembers that. It's about an elephant. Oh, he's in Snake Eater 2, probably playing a villain. A couple of three or four episodes of Friday the 13th, the series, also Toronto filmed, so that's not surprising. Street Legal, a bunch of episodes of that. And then, yeah, he's Turner Edison. I used to love this show. From 1990 to 93, Maniac Mansion. Does anybody remember that? It was a video game as well, but the television show didn't really have much to do with the video game. And actually, it's a little relevant right now. Maniac Mansion, the TV show, was created by Eugene Levy, him and his son just won Emmys for Schitt's Creek. I wonder if Dan Levy was ever a guest on the show way back when he was a kid, because he would have been really young. But yeah, this was a really fun kind of not really horror. It would have been more like an eerie Indiana. But Joe Flaherty was the dad. He's also from SCTV. And George Buza, he played the son, but because of an experiment, so he's like a 5-year-old kid, but he's in the body of this giant 45-year-old man. It's funny. It's funnier than it sounds. I'm not giving it its due. Anyways, that's what I always remember him from. And The Brain, too. This movie, there's only the two villains, and George Buza does a lot of the running around, so... Yeah, he's memorable, totally. And his IMDb, geez, I'm still in the 90s, but I can't... It goes on and on and on. A lot of voice work lately. Lots of Toronto voice work for George. And he's still working. He's got a neat interview on the... I've got the Scream Factory Blu-ray of this movie, The Brain. And he does a little interview from his... Well, I guess it's like a dining room or something. I was going to say apartment, but it could be a house. You can't tell. He's still just this giant, intimidating figure, but throughout the interview, there's a cute little kitty walking through the house, so any giant with a kitty can't be that bad. I'll keep going through the cast here. I just wanted to mention, because I'm going to talk about the opening scene. We'll start the movie here soon, but there's an actress, Susanna Hoffman, who's in it, and she's, a victim? Yeah, she's the second victim, but... Anyways, when we get to the movie, we'll talk about it. She's from Montreal, but she's in a couple of great episodes of Friday the 13th, the television series that I really love. Wax Magic and The Baron's Bride. Look at this. She's in TNT as well. Not the same episode as Cynthia, but there it is. Also Night Heat. Yeah, sorry, let me just start over there. So Susanna Hoffman is a Quebecoise actress who is in this movie. And her career's a lot longer than I thought, too. Lots of early Canadian television. No Littlest Hobo, unfortunately. But Night Heat and Anne of Avonlea, TNT, and then The Brain. Yeah, like I said, those two episodes of Friday the 13th series. She was also on My Secret Identity. Boy, if you worked in Toronto, there was a lot of stuff that people popped up on that's... Yeah, it's neat. A couple episodes of Goosebumps. Oh, and X-Files, so she must have went out west to work. Out west to work, say that 5 times fast. Yeah, Outer Limits, that's also a Vancouver show. So yeah, she went out west eventually. was working, oh, more recently working on Slasher, the television show, and up till about a year ago, the Frankie Drake Mysteries, which is a, I believe that's a Toronto show, so maybe she's back this way. Because flights across Canada, if you're not from Canada, they are not cheap. I guess if you're making actor money, they're okay, but man, I couldn't afford to just zip back and forth to the West Coast. So I think that's all I need to go over with in the cast. I'll start getting into describing this movie and a couple of my favorite scenes, and then I'll let you go. So like I said, this is a fun horror movie. It's pretty high concept. Like I said, a lot of the, they're not early Canadian, but tax shelter, or this is end of tax shelter. There are still some bonuses for filming up here at this point. So you get people that take risks because there's less money to lose, or, you know, in the actual tax shelter era, no money to lose. You get big ideas. This is kind of, in the tradition of a lot of old brain horror movies. Like there's the, I think it's 1957, The Brain from Planet Aras, which actually the brain in this movie kind of reminds me of. I think the look is a bit copied because eventually this brain's got eyes and, well, even a mouth. It gets nutty. And then there's obviously there's Fiend Without a Face, and there's another really good one, the Evil Brain from Outer Space, and the Brain That Wouldn't Die. So, you know, there's this semi-tradition of high-concept, crazy-storied brain villain movies, and this one falls right in line with those. It's definitely got a sci-fi bent. If you look at the IMDb description, it's not great, but it'll give you an idea of what's going on. With the help of an alien organism, a man brainwashes audiences through television, and a troubled high school student is determined to stop them. Well, that's a pretty basic description of this movie, but it does tell you what's going on. David Gale is kind of the mad scientist, and he's got this alien brain that helps him control people through his television show. He's basically making zombies. So I'm going to start it here, and we'll do a little watch through again. Of course, I edit this all down. We're not going to be here for an hour and a half, but I just want to make sure I don't miss any of the scenes I wanted to talk about. So here we go. The movie actually opens on the research institute here, where the doctor, David Gale, has his television show broadcasting from, and the brain, which you get to see. There's no hiding the monster in this one. This is not Jaws. We show you everything right away, and it's so neat. At this point, the brain grows through the movie, and this is the smallest it is, which is still like, geez, medicine ball size. It's this browny green pulsating brain in a tank with it's got like the spinal cord kind of coming off it for some reason, and it's actually not even in the tank. It of course does not touch the water at all, because putting latex in water is not a good idea. But you're getting kind of an idea of the television show that David Gale's running here. And I thought this would be kind of an appropriate movie to do. It's obviously wintertime, although the movie was shot over a long period of time, so sometimes it looks like early spring, sometimes it looks like early winter, but there's Christmas decorations up, so it's obviously supposed to be Christmas time. And this opening scene is just so awesome and intense. They obviously spent a lot of the effects budget here, because you don't really know why at this point, but the actress I mentioned, Susanna Hoffman, she's a teenager at this point. She's up in her bedroom, and her mom wanted her to come down and watch the show, and she doesn't want to watch the show. She's up in her room, and the makeup starts moving, and now her teddy bear is bleeding from the eyes, which is a really interesting look. She can't get out of her room. The whole room is actually a set, and it's pretty neat, because tentacles and arms start busting out of the walls and the television. They're really well done and slimy. This is all practical effects, but it's super intense and again, really well done. She's a pretty good actress. She grabs a pair of scissors to try to stab these tentacles. Again, this is pretty out there. The whole room starts to... The walls are coming in on her. The set, you know how it... built to compress, right? Looks a bit like a trash compactor, and the tentacles are all coming at her. This would have been quite the special effect back in Toronto in 1988, and it looks so good. She's screaming. You really got to see this opening scene. Even if you don't watch the movie, you can probably check out this scene on YouTube. Anyways, it basically leads her to madness. It drives her insane, and she ends up stabbing her mom with the scissors. Her mom's just coming in to ask for help, but she sees her as an antagonist or part of this the tentacle monster that's coming at her. It's a pretty neat cold open scene because you really don't know what's going on. And then it'll just end up cutting from this. Actually, before this scene ends, the brain is trying to get in through her mirror. This looks great too. And it sends her basically flying out the window, which is a great stunt. Yeah, it looks like Christmas outside, I guess. There's decorations and light everywhere. And as the scene switches to our main protagonist, and I guess that's sort of the angle here, that all the parents are definitely into David Gale's show. He's like this professor who's doing like self-help. He's got like a self-help show where he helps you better your life, and it allows him to manipulate the teenagers too. If they don't, you know, like, well, he's manipulating everybody. So if your kids aren't behaving, or what, you know, because they probably don't want to watch the show and be brainwashed, he has you as parents bring your kids to the center for treatment, and then that's where, you know, the hard cases, anybody he can't get hooked on the television show, he's gonna absorb or assimilate right at the treatment center. And that's the case with our main hero here, Tom. He plays Jim Majaluski. It's kind of a bit of a rebel without a cause thing here. He's got the leather jacket and his neat old car, which, by the way, if you're wondering, that's a old Pontiac Strato Chief. You won't see a lot of them. Certainly not up here in Canada. They all rusted away. But actually, this kind of shows how things change with age. This is funny. So when before I get into that, I just want to mention, it is COVID, and here Jim is pulling into his high school. It's Meadowvale High School. And yeah, since, you know, when COVID hit, there wasn't a lot going on, and there still isn't. I've got a lot more time than I intended to. I thought, what the heck, let's make an afternoon of it, and we'll drive 2 hours down the road and see if Meadowvale High School is still there. And actually, it turns out it was. So my wife and I took a little drive. It was about maybe 3 hours round trip into this neighborhood, and man, is it different. It's all built up. When he pulls into this high school parking lot, there's like empty spaces and trees, and you can see a bit of a mall. Well, now it's all built up. That mall is still there. All those trees are huge. School still looks the same. The doors are a different color. We didn't go inside, though. I mean, I think COVID or no, they frown on weird adults wandering around high schools taking pictures. But what I wanted to mention is, so the movie kind of presents this as a bit of a, you know, a sci-fi rebel without a cause. He's the hero of this movie. But basically, he's kind of an ass. I mean, as a kid, I was probably very on his side. Like, he's going into the bathroom here of his high school, and he's got a container of pure sodium, which I don't know if this happens in real life. I'm not doing the research. But anyways, he puts the sodium into the toilet and flushes it, and it causes all the urinals, all the sinks, all the toilets to explode and back up water. This whole toilet is unusable. There's tons of damage. Like, this guy's an ass, man. You just caused a ton of damage. But it's just that perspective that's funny. When I was younger, I definitely thought this was hilarious, and I definitely would have wanted to try this. I know I can remember thinking, wow, I should find out if this is real. But now as an adult, man, that's not cool, dude. It's sort of, my wife and I had a bit of a conversation. She's a huge Harry Potter fan. I like Harry Potter a lot too, but you know, her perspective has changed. When she first read it, she was mentioning this to me. We took a camping trip at the end of this summer, and we listened to one of the books, audiobooks, while we were driving. And her perspective was that the Weasley twins were funny and entertaining when she was younger. But yeah, now as an older adult, man, why don't you give your mom a break and calm down, guys? So yeah, not a good role model. Anyways, Majaluski gets in a lot of trouble here. And this is the setup. So they want to send him... he's been a prankster his whole school career, and he feels even though he's a straight A student, he should be allowed to get away with some of this stuff. Oh, and of course, it's a Canadian movie, so you gotta have an American flag in it. There's no way we could just set this movie in Toronto. It must be set in the US. You gotta have flags everywhere to make sure. See, we're in the States. Look, we're in the States. But yeah, so back to the setup. Now they have a reason to have some conflict here. So the principal feels that Jim needs help and therapy, and maybe we should send him to Dr. Blakely's research facility. And that's David Gale's character, sorry. So yeah, David Gale, the villain, he's Dr. Blakely. And Tom here, he's Jim Majewski. And we're going to also meet his girlfriend. That's the actress Cynthia Preston. She plays Janet. And that's all the main important characters for the rest of this movie. That moves along typically here. His parents kind of agree with the principal. Yeah, you're getting out of control. And isn't this doctor trying to do great things? We'll send you there. And that's the main conflict in the movie. Jim starts to find out that there's weirdness going on at the research institute, and people that watch the show and are in the institute to be, you know, behaving weird and strangely, and he'll figure out that, you know, the brain is kind of doing everything, and hopefully he'll defeat the bad dudes. And as he's he takes himself to the research institute, and it's called the Psychological Research Institute, but it's the Xerox Research Building in Mississauga. There's a funny story in the commentary that it's a very interesting and unique looking building. It looks a bit like a spaceship. It's neat architecture. If you haven't seen the movie, you can just look up, like I said, it's the Xerox Research Center of Canada. Very nice architecture. But also, when I said that my wife and I took that trip, well, it's not a trip, we just drove down the highway for an hour and a half into Mississauga to see where this movie was filmed. But I had looked this up as well, so it's funnily enough, if you're interested, you can check out this as well. They're both in the same neighborhood. The school and this Xerox Research Institute are both off Winston Churchill Boulevard, between the QEW and the 407. So, you know, not hard to find. But the funny thing about this is the interiors look great, and you would think it's the same building, but Xerox allowed them to film outside of the building, but they would not let them in the building, not even one inch. The director's like, well, we were allowed to push the camera about a half inch into the building. So all the building interiors are actually the Ontario Science Center, which is another cool building. And if you're in Ontario, in Toronto particularly, it's a nice day. The Ontario Science Center's got a lot of cool things to see. But I've actually been in this building a long time ago, too, when I was a teenager. I didn't recognize it, though. But you can definitely tell why they wanted to use it. The look on the outside of the building is very unique. It almost looks like a fake sci-fi building, but it's definitely real. There's some funny stuff going to go on here with David Gale and Jim meeting. So he hooks him up to the brainwave machine. And he's trying to, I think he's trying to, well, control him anyways. So he's trying to affect what he's seeing. And here's, it's kind of funny. You can, this is sort of typical of a Canadian exploitation movie. You know, well, we have to put nudity in it. Oh, okay. I guess we'll do that. Well, how are we going to do that? I can just picture them on set. Christine, we're going to do this scene, and I need you to take your top off. But don't move. Don't move. We don't want those breasts to move or jiggle in the slightest. This is a very proper Canadian production here. Just funny to me how, I don't know, I feel like in an American movie they would have a little bit more interesting nudity than a woman standing there holding an apple with no shirt on. It's about the dullest pair of boobs you're ever going to see. But we finally get to see the brain after this, because whether or not it's working on Jim, he's playing the rebel, so he's pretending it doesn't affect him at all. And then David Gale wants to know what's going on, so when they get back into his room where the brain actually is, it's a really nice set. It's well done. But the brain is in this funny, weird tank of green water. Kind of looks like reanimator fluid, which is, I don't know if it's an homage or a little hint, a nod to it, but the brain just looks so floppy. They're obviously moving the tail, and the brain just looks so, I don't know, it's not really doing much. You know, George Buzo's kind of making the tail move. It's a little bit on the low budget side, but it just adds to the charm of this movie. And the colors are great, actually. Everything is got interesting production value. Anyways, Jim's basically, he's catching on to what's going on. Something weird is happening, and he's going to spend the rest of the movie trying to get away from David Gale, who's basically got control of the entire town. He tries to tell his girlfriend. His girlfriend, Cynthia Preston, believes him. They basically are on the run the rest of the movie. But since Gale has control of most of the town, he kind of sets it up. He tells the cops that the kid murders someone, and everybody's under his mind control, so there's basically nowhere to run. It's got a little bit of a Invasion of the Body Snatchers vibe, because there's nobody you can trust. And so Janet and Jim spend the rest of the movie basically on the run. It's a chase-type situation until the end confrontation back at the research center. But, of course, it's a pretty neat scene because... So we get to a point where even Janet is brainwashed now, right? So Jim is on his own. He's alone, and the doctor is about to have his big broadcast where he's going to broadcast nationally. So everybody's like zombies walking into the research center. But if you look at the scene, now that you know that they weren't allowed in the building, the scene always cuts right before you see someone enter the building. I thought that was kind of funny. So we had Jim being chased, and he's made his way into the Research Institute, and he finally confronts David Gale live on television. And if this isn't an homage to Reanimator, I'll eat my hat. He punches the doctor, his head literally flies off, lands on the floor, decapitated, with green fluid spilling out of it. It's a really good effect, but it's got to be an homage to Reanimator. And all of national television has seen it. And this is pretty cool. Now the brain, I mentioned earlier, it's been growing throughout the movie. It's at its hugest that it's going to be. It's like, Jesus, monstrously sized. It's as big as, bigger than a human. Bigger than George Buza. And so the end chase scene is a lot of fun. It's practical effects out the ass. This giant foam brain chasing both of the leads. George Buza's got his gun. He's chasing too. And actually, it's kind of cool. The brain gets to eat him in a really, really neat scene. Lots of blood. I mean, he basically falls into the mouth of the brain, so it's kind of hilarious. But his legs are sticking out and flailing. There's blood flying everywhere. And it's funny, in the commentary, they were running out of money and time at this point in the shoot. It wasn't, like I said, it's not a full tax shelter movie, but there were still some tax shelters in 88. But the way they work is that you have to be done principal photography by December 31st. Like, in the year you're filming, you got to be done. So they ended up, the last day of shooting ended up being 36 hours straight, and they had filmed a lot of this chronologically, so this is a lot of the end. They didn't have a ton of money, so if you look really close, especially on this Blu-ray, you can see that George Buza's legs are, they're just two 2x4s with pants on, kind of moving. It is what it is. It's good stuff, though. Don't worry about it. And that's kind of the end of the movie. They defeat the brain. There was foreshadowing, right? Jim had that pure sodium in the beginning, so he knows if you mix it with water, it explodes. The brain is obviously very juicy and gooey. So while they're in the basement of the research center, he finds some sodium, and he ends the brain's reign of terror. And it's kind of a happy ending. I was I was kind of expecting that it would be some twist where, you know, the brain pops out again at the end. It doesn't really. I mean, in the credits you do see it, but it's not actually part of the movie. I would have done it like 2 minutes before. Actually have it in a scene with the actors where he pops out again. Maybe this happy ending was all in Jim's mind, but whatever, that's nitpicking. This is great, cheesy, entertaining, really good practical effects, good acting. This is an entertaining movie worth watching. If you haven't seen it, I think it's on Shudder. And man, I picked up this Scream Factory Blu-ray here in Canada for less than $20. So probably in the States and the UK, that's, you know, less than $15. Definitely worth getting. This gets a 7 out of 10 from me. Highly recommend. All right, well, I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. Sorry it took so long. We're going to try to be a little more consistent here. And because I've mentioned it almost every episode, next time, join me. I'm going to talk about the tax shelter era, what that was, some of the movies that came out of it, and even what happened to Canadian filmmaking after, up until very recently. Kind of tell you, you know, once the tax shelter era ended, Canadian film production didn't end and actually grew and thrived. Well, it had a down period, but we'll get to that next week, or next episode, sorry. Anyways, thanks for giving me your time. I hope you enjoyed the show. If you do, share it with your friends. If you have any show ideas, I'm on Instagram, The Great Fright North. Message me there. Facebook, Dave Roy. If you tell me you're one of my listeners, I will friend you. Thanks. Bye.